Hey everyone, welcome back to Deeper Than Dough. Today I'm excited to bring you part two with Amy Greensmith. In this episode, we dive even deeper into topics like psychedelics, hypnotherapy, emotional intelligence, and how upbringing shapes self-worth. Amy shares her incredible insights on finding your voice, setting boundaries, and embracing emotional freedom. Don't forget to like and subscribe to never miss a weekly episode. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Deeper Than Dough podcast. I'm super excited to have Amy Greensmith back on the show. Amy, I think you're the first guest to repeat, and I'm super excited because on the first show, I was like, we need a repeat. So Amy, welcome back.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. I just reviewed our first conversation and it got me really excited to chat again.
I know, we were just kind of reviewing what we're going to go over on this podcast, and it's some psychedelics, some religious upbringing, hypnotherapy, a lot of really good stuff. So, but for the listeners who didn't catch the first episode, can you start us off with a minute or two of your background?
Sure. So I think that, you know, for many of us who end up kind of teaching and educating in the online space, we have our own set of trials and tribulations that we went through, and my situation is very similar to that. So for a bit of context, I grew up in a very conservative, born-again Christian family, which I know you know what that's like to have a lot of dogma around you and your upbringing. And a lot of my motivation was from a place of guilt and fear and being like the good kid. And everything really kind of came to a head for me where I had to really grapple with my own sense of self-worth, in the sense that who am I if I no longer believe in this like deity that gets to dictate my worth, et cetera. And it kind of came to a head in 07 when my father passed. And I have shared before on the show that I felt very convicted that I wanted to do his makeup for his viewing. So, you know, not like a daily activity to just do makeup on corpses, but it was a very important thing to me at the time. And I spoke to the crowd of hundreds there. So really kind of feeling like I was killing it at daughter that day. And we get back home to my mom's house and she finds it the perfect time to tell me that she feels as though my father and her had failed as parents, because both myself and my two siblings were not, quote, walking with the Lord. So because we were not subscribed to the faith traditions, it was, you know, I know you've had very much the similar situation. It was like, it doesn't matter to us who you are, what your character is, as long as you are saved and devout and pious, you're good. And that was really sort of a pivotal moment for me, because up until that time, every time I engaged with my parents, I kind of put up this facade, this, you know, artifice and or edifice, I should say. And I felt like this was the moment of I either just acquiesce and do what she wants, say what she wants, or I choose me. And I do feel very strongly that oftentimes when you are speaking up for yourself or you're establishing a boundary, it oftentimes is not an ultimatum. But when push comes to shove and I have to decide between making them happy, like my parents happy, or making me happy, that was the moment when I decided I'm choosing me.
What age were you at to put this in perspective?
I think I was, so let's see, this was 07. So I was probably right about 28 and 27, 28. I was just about to turn 28. And I was really heavily involved in law of attraction at the time. You know, that was, I don't know if you might be a little young for it, but there was this huge surge. Secret.
Yeah. My sister's 15 years ish older than me, very into all of that. It's funny, 'cause now we're like, after I've been making fun of her for 15 years, now I'm coming back. I'm like, oh, you were right the whole time. Sorry.
Yeah. So, and funny, I just cleaned out my office and I found my DVD of The Secret, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is hilarious. But yeah, so I kind of thought as he was passing, I thought, ooh, I'm just going to manifest him into healness or into wellness, into healing. And that didn't work. And so not only was my faith in sort of the metaphysical world rocked, I didn't really have a solid basis and understanding of it. But also, I was so clear that I was not subscribing to what my parents believed. And I was just so sick of doing that tap dance of, maybe they'll still approve of me if they don't know all of the behind the scenes stuff of what I really believe. And it just hit this breaking point. And that really lended itself to the work that I do now, which I really kind of put in two major categories. One piece is believing that your voice actually matters, believing that you are enough. It's that whole self-worth concept. And we use different semantics for that. Some people say deserving or that I matter. But in essence, what we're talking about is worthiness. And then the second kind of bucket of the work that I do is, okay, if I believe that I am enough, how does that now inform the rest of my relationships? How do I show up in communication with my coworkers, my boss, my spouse, my children, my parents, my friend circle? So I do a lot around untethering the reason why we people please, which is quite antithetical to speaking up for yourself. And then what are the, like, what the fuck is a boundary and how do you do it? And what's the anatomy of a difficult conversation? And why do I keep having the same argument over and over and over again? So those two components lend themselves quite well to one another. So that's what I do in my corner of the world.
Awesome. I love that. There's so much to unpack there, though.
Yes.
I want to start with the religious part, because I think, you know, maybe in the United States, a lot of people, or some people relate to that. But whether it's religion or something else, it's growing up in a household with parents that have defined their self-worth and happiness on something external. It could be religion. It could be a community. It could be whatever. And then now they want you to do the same. And then it kind of turns into a cult when it's like, hey, we love one another, but if you're not part of us, sorry, you're not going to go to heaven with us. We're better than you. We're not going to say that, but that is written in our doctrine and we feel bad that you're going to go to hell. So, you know, it's a cult, at least to me. And it's very like egotistical of like, no, we're right. Nobody else has it, but also we're humble. We just, you know, just don't look into the doctrine. So a lot into that. So I kind of started my journey away from religion into spirituality, I guess that's what I'd say, about the same age, 27, 28 years old. For me, it was mushrooms that kicked me off. And it like changed the entire trajectory of my health, my wellness, my business, everything, to be able to really start expanding my consciousness and focusing on it. Did psychedelics play any role for you?
Well, it's interesting. I am definitely a proponent for plant medicine. I don't have any experience with it, but I'm super open to it. And I really do think that we're at a really unique time in history. And I speculate that within the next 5 years or so, we will have a completely different understanding of consciousness, human consciousness, what we're capable of. And you and I were talking before we hit record about this new documentary out called The Telepathy Tapes. And I think that's lending it. Yes. If you have not listened to it, first of all, where have you been? Because it knocked Rogan out of the top spot.
That's where I saw it this week. And I'm like, what is this? Well, explain to us, what is it?
Well, Telepathy Tapes is basically it's kind of an expose in the scientific world of a myriad of different educators, parents, scientists, researchers who've been ostracized for bringing up their real life lived experience where they have a nonverbal autistic child who, through various methodologies, and they talk about it a lot in the documentary, are able to actually read the mind of their, usually it's their primary caregiver, whoever they are the most kind of intimately attached to.
100% accuracy. I mean, I've only listened to the first episode, but they threw up cameras everywhere. They got skeptics in there. They have professors. They have neuroscientists. They double, triple, and quadruple checked. They did randomized tests, randomized pictures, randomized numbers on apps that they downloaded right then and there randomly, you know, and with 100% accuracy. And to give a little bit more background, it's you have all of these nonverbal autistic people. The story that it went into the first episode, Mia and Ileana, which is funny because my daughter's Mia and my wife is Ileana from Mexico. They're going through all of that. And it was when COVID, if I remember correctly, it was COVID. Now she has an iPad and now her communication skills get a lot better. And it was very similar to other people, right? It's, hey, they're autistic. They can't speak. There's nothing going on in their head. Then you give them some technology and show them how. And it's like in Mia's words, you know, I am not sick. That's what she said. Like as soon as she started, like, I'm not sick. I'm perfectly normal. Right. But man, what a hard thing to go through for everybody involved. One thing that I thought of is like, could you imagine if your kids could read your mind? Like, as far as like, wouldn't that hurt your kids so bad? Because you have negative, everybody has negative thoughts or angry thoughts or whatever, because they just come up. And then your daughter being able to pick up on every single thing. I'm like, that's got to be hard for the daughter to really, you know, have that openness. But anyways, keep going into the, so what does this mean? What does this telepathy tapes mean, I guess?
Well, what we're also seeing is that's not that different from being hyper empathic. So I'm reading a book right now called The Language of Emotion, and it is by Carla, I'm forgetting her last name, but it is exceptional. And she's talking about, from an empath perspective, experiencing very similar things. And I know that I wouldn't say I'm hyper empathic, but I definitely am, where if I am engaging with somebody through their body language, through how they are, their cadence, their rhythm of voice, I can tell what is happening with them. I know that they're uncomfortable or that they want to leave or that they're, and so she has this poem that she shares where she talks about, I hear your mom say that she wishes she never had children. I hear the doctor say he doesn't care about this practice anymore. And she's talking about, like, I hear as an empath. So she's not talking at all from a telepathy standpoint. But I think, to my point is, I think the things that we've been dancing around, whether it be with, you know, hypnosis, like what I do, or recognizing that a lot of empaths are cultivated from a survival skill of needing to tap into and recognize what other people are thinking or feeling in order to stay safe. Like, oh shit, dad's on a rampage. Here's how I can take care of myself. And there's varying degrees of that. But I think these things that we've been talking about, and in spiritual communities, metaphysical communities, talking about, you know, transcendental meditation or ways that we can have out-of-body experiences, in psychology, calling it disassociation from the body, I think that there's going to be major learning for us in that area of consciousness, that we will realize that we have capabilities far beyond what we think. And one of the things that we hear a lot in that documentary in particular is how the scientific community has overwhelmingly come from a materialism vantage point, meaning I need to see it, hear it, feel it. I need to be able to prove it. It needs to be material substance in front of me. So this idea that the brain could have capacity that's actually outside of the physical body really starts to freak people out. So we're seeing a massive pushback from the scientific community. In fact, there are folks in the documentary who are saying, we're putting our career on the line here because we can be ostracized as the current quack, right? Yep. And there's a lot of people saying they're grifters, they're this and that. It's been debunked. But what they are asking for, what they are begging for, is more scientific research. They want the peer-reviewed studies. They want to do that because they are experiencing something that is literally out of this world. And I don't think it's that much different than our discovery of microorganisms, right? Like, we never had, or electricity. That always was available to us. It always existed, but it took us discovering it. And I think the exact same thing is happening around consciousness right now.
I like that a lot. I mean, another way that, at least in my mind, that I phrase that what science is trying to do, it's all intellect, right? And we're smart, you know, we have great brains, but look at the brain's capacity compared to one cell's capacity in your body, right? Mm-hmm. One cell has more memory than your brain ever will. And it's like, there is a higher intelligence in the body. We know that. I mean, I shouldn't say higher intelligence. We know there's something going on that regulates our blood and our insulin and every single hormone every day of every second. And then we say, let's ignore that and just focus on this thing called the brain and the intellect. If it doesn't make sense to the intellect, let's just throw it out. And it's like, wait a second, are you throwing the baby out with the bath? You know, like, we know that the body's capable of these incredible things. If you just take, again, one single cell, it has more information than any computer that we've ever built. Yeah. And it's like, how do we start trusting in that and using our intellect to realize the limitations of our intellect? Which then carry us on to, okay, now where do we go from here? For me, it was mushrooms again, specifically mushrooms, had that role. Like, when you start talking about empathy, I told myself I didn't have empathy. Then I started taking mushrooms and I'll cry 5 times a week and I'm doing it on purpose, like on purpose. Mm-hmm. And like last night I watched Moana. Why did I cry during Moana? At the end scene, you know, the giving the heart of Tafiti, I'm with my kids. And I'm just like, I want to open myself up and experience tears of joy every day because Sadhguru, the book that I'm reading, does. And I'm like, wow, this is actually possible if you open up your body to it and leave your intellect aside and go more on the emotional, you know, higher intelligence side.
I can't wait for you to get through the entirety of this documentary because in the very final episode, they have messages that are coming through from all of these autistic folks. Some of them are adults. Some of them are like working and doing, and these are nonverbal folks. And they share all of the things that we have collected as data, like the flapping of the hands. And they say, I'm so disconnected from my physical body. I flap my hands to remind me where my physical body is. Or when they are covering their head because there's too much noise or too much outside stimuli, that is because they are connecting with consciousness, so many different consciousnesses, I don't know what the plural is, that it is so overwhelming that they have to shield all of the messages that they're receiving. So then in the final episode, they share, these are the messages we want to impart to people. And one of the key messages, which I felt so validated around, was emotional intelligence. It was the stuff that we run from, right? We are such emotional spirits and beings, yet we really try to nurture that out of ourselves. When we know scientifically that we make decisions, almost every decision based off of how we want to feel, focusing in the limbic center of the brain. So for example, if we want to connect, or if we want to be successful, it's because we want a feeling of freedom or peace or happiness. We're always chasing an emotional feeling. But we really demonize that in our culture, really poorly with men, where we say the only emotion you're permitted to feel is anger. So lash out, get it out that way, which is why, you know, we have epic levels of abuse. But what a disservice. What a disservice to largely to men or those identifying as men to say you have to cut off all of your emotional intelligence because God forbid you do something that we have ascribed as feminine. And it's fucking not. It's just human. It's a way we've been socialized. So, but one of the things they're really talking about, and you're talking, you know, you're kind of saying like, why wouldn't they want to do this? Why wouldn't you want to study? Why wouldn't you pay attention? It will cause massive disruption to people's faith, to their beliefs about the afterlife, to their beliefs about the physical text that they've been studying as God's word. And so there are a lot of social implications that will disrupt major markets in the US. So not to come back to capitalism, but that's a piece of it.
Yeah. I like that you said, again, we have intellect, and intellect is, for a lot of us, maybe for me, I don't know, that's the easiest to go off of because it's like, it's tangible. I can see my thoughts. They consume my every single thing and I'm trying to get away from. But again, it's like, okay, intellect, I'm not going to focus on emotion because my intellect, you know, I could reason with it. It makes more sense to me. But diving deeper into it, I came to the same conclusion as you. Well, logically speaking, intellectually, I could evaluate every decision and link it to an emotion that I want to feel. So I'm like, oh, wait, so logically, intellectually, life is all about emotion. So how do I get off track? And it's like, hey, now how do you get back on track? For me, I honestly thought, and who knows? I think I was a kid that was more sensitive on like the emotional side and the empathic side. And I remember watching like those children, starving kids in Africa, you know, and like not being able to sleep when I was 8 years old. I'm like, why is the world like this? So I think I just blocked it all because I felt it too much. And my mom was a great example. And my dad, I had two amazing examples on how to block every fucking emotion. Just go through life and ignore it all. So for me, I think it was a little bit more of like I was oversensitive and then I was never taught that that's okay. And then I just blocked it all completely.
Which is a complete defense mechanism, right? Mm-hmm. It is, oh, we don't do that in this house. Oh, I'm not safe if I do that. Oh, okay, well, better shut it all down. It's very similar to when somebody is experiencing physical pain, like if you've ever seen those tales of the ER where someone's, you know, egregiously impaled by something and they're like, I didn't even feel it. And it's like the body shuts down. It's the same thing that we do when we shut down our emotional center. And it's to protect us. But you've have a such a great example of plant medicine being a vessel for you to tap into parts of yourself that had atrophied. They're not gone. You can always bring that stuff back. But what you're talking about is something that I call the cognitive override, where regardless what we are feeling emotionally, we try to logically dissect it and what makes the most sense. And this is why people stay in jobs that they fucking hate, because they're like, well, it looks really good on paper. It's good for my resume. It's in a good location. I like the and they're not fulfilled, right? We can rationalize and logic things to death, but it does not mean that it's actually fulfilling for us.
Fulfillment comes from that emotional side. Like what I've studied on mushrooms is that if you put your brain under an MRI on mushrooms, you're going to think that there's all sorts of, you know, like all sorts of parts being activated that normally weren't activated, but it's actually the default mode network, which is where, you know, the ego, the individual who I am is stored, that is quieted. So, and then everything else comes up. So it's really getting rid of that, I guess the ego or that separation and the intellect part. And then it is just the more of the subconscious that now you're aware of. And you're like, wait, I've had these thoughts, because mushroom trips for me, I will tell you the top five worst experiences of my life, you know, in terms of like negative emotion, I think I'm going to die. All five of them, I've been on mushrooms, you know, but it brings up these things. And I'm like, holy crap, what? It's obviously there. I just block it. And then mushrooms allow me to see it. And then now outside of mushrooms, I can then work on it. I heard Sam Harris, if you've heard of that guy, talking with, who was it? I think it was Andrew Huberman, you know, two science podcasters.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, put 100 people in a room and ask them to meditate, you know, and five of them will be like, wow, that was beneficial. And the other 95 are like, they never even got a focus. Their brain never went quiet. Get 100 people, give them all 1-2 grams of mushrooms. All 100 of them are going to have a different experience. So it kind of kickstarts you to show you, hey, there's a completely new world out there. Not new. There's a completely different world underneath our nose that you can have access to if you take a little plant. So kind of cool. Anyways, I want to kind of use that to transition to the atheist versus having a soul and kind of, I mean, just your beliefs in a God and an afterlife, and how that correlates with the soul.
Well, I identify as an agnostic atheist, and you and I have talked about this before, but if we break this down and we look at what Gnosticism is, I know. If you are a Gnostic, you believe, I know that this is true. If you're an agnostic, you're saying, I don't know. So I feel very confident in that I do not fucking know. I speculate a shit ton. But theism is about a belief in a God. And I really lend myself to Ricky Gervais's perspective around this, that the only reason why the term atheist even exists is because we have to have something to refute how pervasive and overbearing Judeo-Christianity has been in the States, right? In particular, I can speak to that experience. You know, he's talking about it in Europe, obviously. But I think we can't ignore that. And I feel, you know, he also will say like, okay, there, I remember him talking with Stephen Colbert, and he was, you know, Colbert is a Catholic sort of, and he says, you know, you don't believe in 1,500 of the gods, right, that exist. You believe in just one of them. And he's like, well, I don't believe in 1,501 gods. I just don't, you know, so it just depends on how are you defining God. And I heard somebody describe it once as, you know, if you're talking about the God of the Bible or the God of the Quran or any other religious text, then I am an atheist all day. I don't believe in that punitive deity who's going to regulate
the universe.
Right, right.
Punishing you or rewarding you based on if you ate your broccoli or not. Yeah.
However, coming back to the telepathy tapes, they were using the term God a lot. And they were these various autistic folks were using that term a lot. And I think they are using it in a much more accurate assessment of universal connected energy. So not once did they say anything about God other than it being about a connection of love between all of us. There was not one supreme deity. There's no written text with do's and don'ts. There is no worship that's involved. It was simply a statement about, to me, God is synonymous now with universe. For the longest time, I could never do that. I could never give God that credence. I was like, no, that's a fucked up sociopathic deity who kills people who don't worship him, and he needs constant praise because he's a narcissist and he's also a serial killer. So like, I'm like, no, very clearly I'm out. And so it was very, very difficult for me to even use that terminology, but I do think it's a much more expansive concept. So it depends how you describe God. And then, but again, to the soul piece, I don't feel like that has anything to do with a deity or a God or anything like that. To me, that's a scientific realm that we haven't tapped into. And I don't think our souls, again, with this documentary, it was very validating to me also with some other folks that I've conversed with over the years, that I don't think we necessarily even fucking need a body. I think that's sort of our way of moving our soul around this planet. But I believe in reincarnation. I think that, and that's also one of the reasons why I'm vehemently pro-choice. I feel like if that fetus is aborted, I believe that soul will just find another vessel to inhabit. Like, so.
Yeah. So especially in the hypnotherapy kind of construct, because again, I've only listened to the first episode, but it sounds like God is like the mystic version of God, right? God is everything. Mm-hmm. God is what makes us alive. And then that's, you know, God is consciousness. We all have a piece of God. And then we go kind of back to that wholeness, I guess. Which does remind me also, like, I learned a lot about it in that kind of mystic belief. You know, you have the everybody is one, but you're born, and then you have the ego and you're a separate mm-hmm. soul, but the freedom is realizing that you're not really separate, that you're just in this body, mm-hmm. but you're really part of a greater collective. And then people with, you know, telepathy, or they're able to access more of the holistic viewpoint rather than the individualistic. And that's why, yes. like when you said moving your hands, I've read yes. that a lot. Like people that get really into spiritual practices in like the yogic tradition, like they will forget that they have bodies for days and people have to take care of them. I literally listened to that this morning. Mm-hmm. And there are special type of people and societies that will keep these people, you know, fed, and because they can't do it themselves because they're so disconnected and connected as a whole. So anyways, lots to go there. And I know we're wrapping up, but we haven't gotten into hypnotherapy. So tell me about hypnotherapy.
Yeah. So you know how we were just talking about sort of the conscious faculty of the mind and then the subconscious faculty, the consciousness. And again, this depends on who you talk to, but we can roughly say that the conscious part of our mind is about 5 to 10% of the equation. And our subconscious is about, you know, 90 to 95% of the equation. Now, logic, reason, rationale, problem solving, all of that happens in the conscious 5% of the mind. So a majority of what is dictating our life is housed in that 90 or 95% of the subconscious. So that means that no matter how much, for example, in my world, somebody tries to tell themselves consciously, I am enough, I'm worthy, there's 95% of the mind's power that's going, oh, no, the fuck you're not. We already have, because the subconscious houses your fight, flight response. It houses your beliefs, your habits, your, and all of your emotions. So what happens too is that the inner critic, or the critical factor of the mind, is sort of like a little guard dog between what comes in consciously, and it checks for congruence with the subconscious. So if, for example, I developed a belief early on that I need to make everybody else happy in order to stay safe, and I've developed this positive association in the subconscious mind with people pleasing, if I consciously try to tell myself, you can speak up for yourself, that inner critic is going to go, fuck no, you're not. We have all of this belief down here in the subconscious.
Here's the data to say otherwise, right? Like we're not doing that yet.
100%.
What is a hypnotherapy session? And again, I believe so much into this because I think psychedelics help you access to the subconscious mind, and that's where the change is. Or deep meditations. I've been getting into like yogi chants and vibrations in the throat. And it's cool. Like it does get you, it quiets your mind. And at the end of the day, a quiet mind is a happy life. And that's all subconscious. So if I'm doing a hypnotherapy session with you, Amy, kind of what is that like? It seems new and it seems weird. It seems exciting, but kind of walk me through it.
Well, the reason why I bring up all this stuff around the subconscious and why this is important is, and did you just have a little sippy cup? I love that.
I ran out of coffee mug. So this is a unicorn, rainbow, pink. It's my daughter.
I love it.
I brought it to the gym too, and I got made fun of, but whatever.
Well, turns out unicorns don't have a gender. Pink doesn't have a gender.
And rainbows and moons are everywhere. Yeah, no, we're good.
Yeah, those don't have a gender either. So, but the reason why I bring that up is because in our awakened state, the critical factor of the mind is rampant. But when you are in a hypnotic trance, it's almost like that you're giving that little guard dog a little greenie or a little treat and it goes to sleep. So what that means is when somebody is in a hypnotic state, and I'll tell you exactly what that means, we can now feed those concepts like I can speak up for myself or I am enough. And there's far less resistance from the inner critic. You don't have that kickback. So it's able to drop into the sub so much faster. So what is essentially happening? It's just a slowing down of the brainwave state. We all go into hypnosis every single day, at least twice a day, when we're awakening or when we're going to sleep. And so, you know, when we're in a complete sleeping state, that's our delta brainwave state, right? It shuts down motor function so that if we're running in our dream, we're not, you know, flailing our arms around. So theta brainwave is a hypnotic trance. It's just slowing down the brainwaves. That's all. And so it depends on what that person wants to work on or what we're dealing with. But there are tons of different things that you can do while somebody is in that theta brainwave state. But you can actually start to tune into that yourself because we do it, again, as we awaken and as we go to sleep. Have you ever had those situations where you're so delirious that you're like, I don't even know what I'm making. I'm not even making sense. I need to go to bed. I'm so sleepy. You're probably in a theta. You're in theta. That age-old example of, you know, you're driving somewhere, you get to your destination and you don't remember the drive at all. But your subconscious knows how to move the gear shift. It knows the directions. So your conscious mind can be busy thinking about what you should have said to your boss. So that is, and we don't recommend that, you are in a theta brainwave state. So it's in a very, very natural place to be. But I now can recognize it as I'm going to sleep or as I'm awakening. And I use that time to just say a shit ton of mantras to myself.
So I literally just learned about that like 2 weeks ago. Those two windows, you're the most conscious. You're in those theta. And that is when to practice any sort of goals or manifestation because you're already in there. Have you heard of the Heart Math Institute? It's like Joe Dispenza, Brain Heart Coherence. I just bought some device.
I know Joe Dispenza. I know
you put it on your ear and it's measuring your HRV rate along with something else with the heart rate. Something else goes in your chest and it's measuring the brain heart coherence to get you in those states. It's really cool. Like I could breathe normally and I'm in like a one or two. Then I start like different types of breath, you know, slower or like, you know, with some resistance at the back of my mouth, or I do some vibrations like, you know what? And it'll immediately go up to like 3, 4, 5, 6. And you're like, holy crap. And then you also notice your brain just gets so quiet after. So I'm getting very geeky and nerdy because now I can measure it. And my daughter, my 7-year-old daughter, you know, she's there with her hands like this, like trying to get to the fours or fives. It's been fun. But it's cool though, because science is going that direction. Like it's turning the woo-woo into scientific just because now there's more data, I guess, surrounding it all.
What a concept. But I mean, even when we're talking about like medically, when we do EKGs or EEGs, that's a measurement of energy that is, you know, outside of us. So, you know, or if we look at sonar with dolphins, we have a lot of scientific evidence to show that energy can be measured. So I think why couldn't a conscious part of the mind exist outside of the physical body? I think it has. And we are just now able to qualify and quantify it in a way that we can understand. But as we've mentioned before, I do think there is real resistance in the scientific community of being too woo-woo, or now this is transitioning into new age as opposed to valid science. But I think we're going to see something in the next 5 years.
Yeah. I mean, a little bit about that is science in general, right? Even if it's we eat carbs and you're the first scientist to say, no, carbs are bad. Like, it's just going against the norm. And then you add on to the, wait, we've never studied this at all before. Then it's extra like, is this worth it? But I think that the world is big enough. We have enough people. We're connected enough. We're smart enough that this will continue progressing. I mean, yeah, it's here in Utah last year, MDMA and mushrooms got approved. So clinically, it's going to take a few years to roll out. But yeah, it was like April of last year, which is really cool. So there's all these advances taking place. But Amy, this has been great. Cool. I really appreciate you coming on a second time and sharing.
Absolutely.
Now we're going to have to wait another year and we'll do a live hypnotherapy session.
Ooh, that would be cool.
But Amy, what's the best way that people can connect with you, learn more about coaching, hypnotherapy, anything that you're doing?
Yeah. Sure. So you can find me over at amygreensmith.com. And I always say all those names are spelled the basic bitch way, nothing exciting. And there's tons of freebies over there. Get your hands on that. And then I've been in a bit of a social media detox, but you can find me pretty much everywhere under the handle Hey Amy Green Smith. But I tend to hang out the most on Instagram, like any self-respecting Gen Xer. So yeah, come hang out.
Okay, Amy, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All right.